Are you looking to optimize your performance, grow your mind, and change your system? Well, you've come to the right place. I'm Brad Baker.
And I'm Tom Broback.
And this is the Bold Base Performance Podcast.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the show. I'm Tom Broback, and today's guest is Mike Chapman. Mike is a strength and conditioning coach for Stanford men's basketball. I chat with Mike about lifting with intent, serving others, and how to meet your athletes halfway. Mike does a fantastic job explaining the culture he has helped establish at Stanford. You can check out more about him in the show notes. Let's continue to grow the mind and change the system. How did you first get interested in strength and conditioning? Were you playing sports growing up and you wanted to get better, so you looked towards that? Or did you have someone that influenced you? How did you first get involved in strength and conditioning?
Well, my brother was a big workout guy. So obviously you want to be like your big brother to a certain extent. So like that had a big effect on me lifting wise. Like, he was in the Navy. I remember he came home from like this trip. He opened the door. He's like, he was jacked. And I was like, okay, that's kind of cool. So that's how when I think about it, my first introduction to lifting, period. But strength conditioning, I played sports growing up and just wanted to find a way to get an advantage. And you look for everything you can. I thought training would be one of those things. And the more and more I started to train, the more and more I loved it. And I felt more comfortable. I enjoyed training when I did the sports. So I was like, okay, let's see what we got. And I started doing some internships, and I ended up with one of the best mentors I probably could ask for. And he got me on the path, and I've been going ever since.
Who is your mentor?
Gail Hatch is my original mentor. He gave my first day in the field. Oftentimes when you're younger and you have a mentor, they do stuff and make you do things and you think it's stupid and make any sense. But now as an older, wiser man, I realize he was grooming me and setting me up for success, even in ways that I didn't appreciate at the time. So, yeah.
Can you give me a couple of specific things that he would do that you thought, why am I doing this? This is a waste of time. But now you realize the value in it.
Yeah, it was just like the monotonous consistency of how he made me speak and carry myself daily. It was like, he's the most consistent man in the world. I mean, wore the same thing every day, coached the same way every day, like consistency, consistency, consistency. And so when you work with someone like that, they demand you to do that. And so he'd just be on me about how I did things like daily, like do how you did yesterday, do this, do this, do this. And he always had these quotes and he'd say stuff like, stay in the eye of the storm. I'm like, that's stupid. That wasn't even making any sense to wait over no storm. But you know, what he was saying was, always in the mix, always coaching, always working, always active. And believe it or not, like in this day and age, everybody wants to be a sports scientist and pull out all their gadgets and their force plates and all this. If they aren't consistently training properly, it doesn't matter about all that stuff. And so he really taught me how to master the basics. One thing that really annoyed me when I was there is you would do the program as well, but like, you know, you do the hatch system. And for the first like year and a half, my lifts never changed.
That's frustrating.
Not one day did he change a rep, a set, a range. And I'm like, this is so ridiculous. But like once he started manipulating my training, I was so strong. He spent that much time building my base. It was like a year and a half.
Right.
Like just building my base. Like imagine like doing eights and fives for a year and a half.
That would get old. Every Monday you come in and it's like, oh, we got the same thing again. That would get old. But you learned a lot from that. You learned that consistent. Like he showed you, he just didn't tell you. He showed you this is what it takes to be consistent.
Yeah. And no matter what, like when kids came into the gym, I always feel like, you know, you get like the high level athletes coming in. You have like your people. He always gave me, I felt like the worst people to train. And what I learned was like, if you can coach kids, you can coach people who have learning disabilities and people who can have different issues, you can coach anyone.
Right.
Because you become, what I learned there was, as a teacher, you have to vary your delivery for who you're coaching. And so I was able to learn how to teach those lifts that we did. I could teach the clean 9 different ways to 9 different kids because they got it. And so now when I coach now, I think I do a pretty good job of being able to get my guys to do stuff because I evaluate how they learn. And then I go back and I'm like, okay, this is how we're going to teach him, this is how I'm teaching him. And they get better so quickly because of that. So like, I'm not one of the proponents, people like, oh man, like it takes a year to teach Olympic lifts. Like when I got my first job at Penn State, literally I taught the women's hockey team how to clean, snatch and jerk in 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Like every day we did it like a GPP circuit with a barbell. And then we started loading it in week 3 and we just kept going and they were fine. Anything you can teach consistently with proper technique, they'll get better at.
If you go on Twitter, you're going to get a bunch of arguments on that. So we're not here to argue about whether you should do Olympic lifts or not, but it does go to show you that if you are consistent with your message and you have that experience of coaching a lot of different people, you can take something complex, make it simple in order to be effective for athletes like you did at Penn State.
Yeah. And yeah, I am completely not a part of strength coach Twitter. there's no right or wrong way to do anything. And I just think different tools in the toolbox and whatever fits the kid biomechanically is what you do.
Right. And the same with coaching. You just got to figure out what path is the best for you, whether it's simple or complex, whether it's easy or difficult, whether it takes a lot of time, a little time. You just got to figure out what's best for you and your situation, because at the end of the day, you are the one applying what you've learned to the athletes that you're working with.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and I think that's the cool thing. You know, one of my mentors always says, you need to learn different things so you have different tools in the toolbox. Right. If you only have one tool in the toolbox, it makes it hard to fix something. You don't have that tool that quite. So I try to have study everything. You know, I started off a West Side guy. I love West Side.
Yeah,
I love
for sure.
I never had for days. Actually, personally, I prefer to train myself at this point, West Side. So, yeah.
Do you usually work out? Like, do you ever work out with your athletes, or is it always just coach, and then you got to find your own time to train?
There's times when I do, like in the summer times when I have like a small group, like a 2 guys, and like, or sometimes like our older guys who I know, you know exactly what's going on, I train with them, but that's like less than 1% of the time. Most of the time when I'm on the floor and I'm coaching, they have all my attention, they have all my effort, and I want to get them better. So there's a time for it sometimes. Sometimes they need the little boost. You know, sometimes I need to know that you still got it a little bit, you know?
Right.
But, you know, that's few and far in between.
No, for sure. And that's a sign of a good coach, where you can mix it in a little bit, whether you're doing an agility drill or you're doing, overhead lift, something like that, where you can join in and show them that you like being active, that you work out, that you embrace what you teach and what you preach. And I think the buy-in's a lot better than someone who just, you know, sits back and never participates in anything. So I think that's a good sign that a little bit, you know, every now and then, is just to show them who runs the weight room.
Yeah, exactly. Just a little bit.
So going back to consistency, what things do you do in your day-to-day life in order to allow yourself to be consistent at your job?
I have a routine. We start every lift the same way. We do the same things every day. Whether we win by 40 or we lose by 2 at 0.3 seconds, things don't change in my area. I make it very clear that wins and losses don't matter in the weight room. It's a place to get better. And so don't bring that energy into my space. And I kind of demand that of them. I believe in rep to rep consistency. How we do one thing is how we do everything. And it's very regimented. Like, the guys come in now and they know exactly what to do. I don't have to say a word. They just kind of roll through it. And they know that they don't only know how I want it done from a technical standpoint, but how I want it done, more importantly, from a cultural standpoint.
Sure.
We're going to try to maximum intent with everything we do. And they know that if we do a set and it's not maximum intent, I will do that set 30 times in a row before they move on. And I think that's just as important as anything else. Like, you can have no intensity without intent. And I believe intent is incredibly important.
When freshmen first come into the program, are they a little bit, do they take a little bit getting time, getting used to the program, the culture, the fit, or do the older athletes help them come along pretty quick?
So usually I'll separate the freshmen out from the older guys in lifting. Sure. And then they will usually do like some agility conditioning stuff as a group. One of the things that I do that I think may be unique to me, maybe not, whatever, but we have work capacity and then work capacity. So the first weeks are work capacity is how to work, how to unload the bar, how to load the bar, how to move around the room, how to rack this, how to do this, how to move, what pace you're going at. And then the next week we start our work capacity cycle. We start working on volume and GPP type deals. But I think it's imperative that they learn how to work and learn the work habits that need to be successful and how to train. And I think how to train is goes before everything else.
I think it's super important to take the time to teach everybody what the expectations are that first mm-hmm. week, because if you skip that, because to some people it might seem like unnecessary or not a good use of time, but you skip that, you're going to keep having the same problems where athletes are leaving weights out. They're not racking the bar the right way. They're not using clips. They're doing things not up to the system and not up to the standard. And then you're repeatedly having the same issues that could have been addressed in week one. So it seems like in your program, you guys take care of that right away. And then you can just work on growth and getting better from there.
Yeah, that's exactly how I do it. You know, I say we train with a NASCAR pace. So we don't lift and then take 3 to 5 minutes for the sets. Like I know what the science, know what the book says. I do what I know works. I do what I'm comfortable with. And we train with pace. We train with great pace.
Talk me through like a typical session then. So like an in-season session, where you get a guys in, how long it is, how many lifts do you guys do? What do you guys focus on? Walking through a typical workout.
Typically in season, I get 2 to 3 days. I try to get three. So we'll come in and do our movement prep. So I do my joint mobility stuff, then my tissue extensibility. Then I do my 3D movement stuff with my Vipers and med balls and whatnot. And then I transition that into my power or main movement for the day. I usually superset that with some type of core or some type of mobility to support that major. And then I get into more of my auxiliary work where I'm trying to get my volume. So in season, I try to use volume. So we do a little what I call HD days for ESPN, so they have a little size on them. After we do all the meat and potatoes, so it makes them feel a little bit better about themselves. But that's toward the end after we've done our meat and potatoes, our essentials. And then what I like to do is we like to do 50% of our movements in the sagittal plane, 25% in the frontal, 25% in the transverse. So I was in that fascia down in a good position, so we're always gonna be healthy. I'm a big believer in movement, and I believe you move so you can load. And so it's extremely important that when you go through that process, that my guys never enter position on the court that they haven't touched in the weight room. Sure. So we train in ranges, we train in close range, we train in funky positions, unnatural positions, because they're going to get there in the game, and avoiding them doesn't make them safe. Avoiding them puts them more at risk.
Right.
So that's kind of how we go about that stuff. I keep training pretty simple in my mind. Sometimes it looks more complex than it actually is, but I want the training to be so simple that they can focus on giving me intent.
Exactly. Don't cloud their mind up with a bunch of numbers and philosophies and a bunch of, you know, big words. It's just like, this is like, that's your job, is take these complex thoughts, make it simple for them. So when they are working out, they know this is what I have to do and I'm getting after it.
Absolutely. And so that's what they know, like, it's funny, like sometimes I'll coach guys and I'll be like, that wasn't good enough. And next one's like, do it again. Like, they're so programmed to know if it's not done the right way. Do it again. Like, no, not today. But you know, it makes you feel good when that they know what the expectation is and they're willing to do it again because they want to get better. But that's also a testament to the good kids we have here as well.
So if I were to go over to the Stanford football weight room, and then I came over to Stanford basketball weight room, what would look different? And what I mean by that is basketball players have some unique demands and also differences from football players in terms of what they need to get after in the weight room. What kind of things would you do differently with a basketball player than a football player?
That's a great question, because typically I always say I don't know anything differently because I just see mechanics. But I just think my guys have longer levers.
Right.
So I have to be more careful and I have to take my time a little bit longer, where they may have a 6-foot corner I might have a 6'7" freshman or 7-foot freshman. So I have to take a little bit longer to get them through that baby deer phase where they have a little more stability before I can load them. Cullen does a great job in football, by the way. I think, you know, for the most part, to be really real with you, I don't change anything. Like, we're going to train. What you can do, you're going to do. Now, if you can't do something, I'll modify. But, like, my expectation is that we're going to train hard. We're going to train fast. And we're going to train biomechanically smart. And so that really what drives me. So I guess maybe they may do more sprint work than me early on and whatnot. But other than that, when it comes to weight room stuff, we're moving weight. The moment you can load and move and absorb force, and we're going.
Yeah, that makes sense. The longer levers is what I was trying to get at, because growing up, I didn't understand that, you know, if you're 6'7" versus being 5'8" like me, it's going to be different getting to parallel in a squat or getting a bar off the ground. Like, there are adaptations that to an untrained eye might seem like these guys have it easier, they're not working as hard, but it's so much different when you're working with someone who's in that, you know, 6'5", 6'7", 6'8", 6'10" range than your prototypical, you know, 5'8" or 5'10" or 6 foot, you know, high school or college athlete.
And you know, that's, man, our field is so great, but it's so interesting in some ways. Like, I'm not fighting about how deep a kid's squatting. Like, if you can't squat the parallel, that's perfectly fine. But you can split squat and lunge to depth. I'm going to get my depth from where you can give it to me. I'm not going to force in a place that it doesn't go.
Right.
So if your hips don't allow you to give me a bilateral front squat that's full depth as the grass, I'm okay with that. I'll squat to the depth that you can handle, and then I will do Bulgarians, lunges, reverse lunges, high box step-ups to make up the difference, and I'll work on your mobility over time and try to get you there if you can get there. And some people biomechanically can't get there, and that just is what it is, you know? And I think that's one of these things, like, training is not absolute. Like, if you train in a system, no offense to anyone, you're a poor coach.
Right.
Because your system should adapt, should reflect the people you're training.
Right.
So, like, when you look at it, in my mind, like, put it like this, we haven't squatted once this year with a barbell on our back, I don't think. This year, we've done Bulgarians for our single leg strength, for our squat motion. We've trap barred for our more high intensity movement, and we've done RDLs, and that's been a staple. And you know what? Knock on wood, it's been one of my better years with things. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so, like, there's no one way to do it. You got to have tools in your toolbox, and yeah.
No, I agree with you on that, and that's the way I would train. I do a lot of deadlifts. I love the trap bar. I do a lot of single leg stuff. And the barbell squats, like, it doesn't feel good on my back. My low back is sore for 3 or 4 days after. And there's no reason that I have to do that lift in that way. You know, I'm not training to be a power lifter. Like, I am just trying to be, you know, a healthy, active adult. And I try to be as athletic as possible. And I found these things work the best for me. But as a coach, you really need to take the time to learn each kid and understand, or each athlete, and understand what are their demands, what are their, you know, strengths and weaknesses, and how do I adapt my demands for them in order for them to be successful in the weight room. It sounds like you've been doing that with changing different lifts and different expectations throughout the years.
Yeah, I mean, even at Southern Miss years ago, like, when we squat, I let the guys pick their favorite squat. Because they keep getting to the quad dominant. I'm like, all right, man, look, these dudes aren't lifters. Like, they're not going to get that much of this from anything. I'm going to make sure my program has been balanced out. So I had some kids like, yeah, I'm not ever back squat. I'm front squat. And some kids was like, hey, I'm not doing, like, cool. The card would say squat variation.
That's perfect. And I guarantee the kids liked it better when they got to have a little say in what they did within context.
It is. It creates ownership. It creates, you know, they feel included, and they feel like they're working with you and they're not working for you. And that's, in my opinion, that's how you get guys to buy in to train.
And it sets them up for later in life, because they understand, all right, when I'm trying to work on a squat pattern, you know, all these variables exist within it, and I can kind of pick and choose from them. And I understand what we're going after when it says, you know, like a squat variation versus a deadlift variation, or, you know, upper body lift. they're more educated going on later in life, so they can stay active and healthier and more active when they graduate, and they don't have you in the room every time.
For sure. And that is my, you know, we talk about my freshman. When I get my freshman in, I said, guys, I don't know if you're gonna go to the NBA, if you're gonna go overseas, if you're gonna just go be a business person. All of it's great to me. But when you leave here, you will know your body and you will know how to train. You will understand what's going on. Don't just do it because I said do it, which is part of it still.
Right.
But I want you to ask me questions and learn and understand. And the better the kids understand what you're doing and why you're doing it, the more they're going to buy in and the more you're going to give you. And I think that's a lost part of coaching in some points and places.
Well, that's almost the beauty of it, is because that isn't, it's simple to do. It's not easy, you know, to put in that time, that effort, that energy to care. And it can really separate you from an average coach or a standard coach or someone next door, because you're putting that extra effort, that extra care, that extra education, that extra dedication, and it makes you, you know, amazing and stand out in your field. And that's what it should be. And that's what every coach should be striving for, to go above and beyond just giving them the sheet and be like, here you go. Let me know if you have any questions.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, there are different times of years where I would do different things with the guys. And I'm like, there's like no lift. Like, it always kind of rubs me on why people say, I don't believe in this lift. I don't believe in this. Like, but it's not your body.
Right.
It's not your belief. It's like, so you figured out better than 80 years of training. You in the last 10 years have figured out that this is better than this, and you don't believe in this for this reason. And all the reason you can give me is you don't believe in it. Training, this isn't about me. This isn't about what makes me look good as a coach. It isn't about what makes me have followers on Instagram or make me look pop. It's about what's going to get that kid better. So if that kid not deadlifting or not squatting, but doing step-ups, goblet style, eccentrics and pauses and all that stuff, if that's what gets him better, that's what's going to get him better. And that's why sometimes I put myself in a hole, because I make too many groups, because I'm trying to adjust to what I need. But you know, like, the kids appreciate it. And if you're really here to do a service to the kid, you're going to do what's best for the kid, not what's best for you.
Right. And that might take, you know, having, you know, if you have 15 kids in a room, you have four or five different groups. And that's because, you know, some of these kids, they handle single leg stuff better. Some of these kids handle double leg stuff better. Some of these kids need to get out of that lift for a week or two just to, you know, heal up or whatever. And again, it's just another great sign of what a great coach is you're listening to your athletes, you're listening to the other coaches on staff, whether it's a sport coach or another strength coach, and you're not just plug and play your system and it's my way or the highway, get out of my weight room if you're not going to do what I tell you to do. You're embracing the culture, you're embracing the mentality of everyone matters and everyone's important, and I'm here to serve you.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Another thing that I commonly see with basketball players is, I think a typical thing is basketball players don't love the weight room. And then the ones that do see some success in it, then either the player or the coach pushes too much in the weight room, and then it takes away from their jumping ability, it takes away from their leaping ability. It ultimately becomes too much of a focus relative to the basketball court. I've seen some awesome highlights from some of your players this year with some nice dunks. When you are preaching, you know, working out, is there ever a point where the athlete wants to be in the weight room too much and you got to, you know, kick them out or hold them back? Or is that not a common issue with you guys?
I've had guys I've had to hold back a little bit.
Okay.
Because like,
you had guys you had to drag into the weight room too, like on the flip side?
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I can honestly say is I truly believe the way that we develop our culture, I develop my weight room culture, makes all the guys enjoy training to a certain extent. And the guys who don't enjoy training look by and see the guy to the left and right of him getting better. And they're like, I want to get better too. And then they kind of jump on. And I think that's how you kind of do it. The interesting thing is, like, basketball guys get a bad rap for the weight room, but
they most do. Guys, and maybe it's not true. Maybe it's just, you know, a reputation that has gone by, but it is a reputation that's out there.
In my years, I've had maybe two to three guys that don't love to lift. And sometimes you get guys that don't like to lift, but they know they need it.
Right.
And that's fine because they're not here to lift. Like, they're not here to lift.
Right.
But I would challenge anyone's thought process on this, their thought. And if I show you success in an area every single day, are you going to want to come back? Absolutely, because everyone wants to get better.
Right.
If you find something they can get better at every single day, they can measurably see themselves getting better, they'll commit because like, I'm getting better at this. I'm getting better at this. Because on the court, they play good, they play bad. They play good, they play bad. Play good. In the weight room, I can control that. We can always have days like this. When I see they're down, I can tick down a little bit. And they feel like they got better, even though they may have gotten better.
Right.
And I can play that game with them. Coach Hatch was the absolute master of manipulating me, making me think I got better when I didn't. And I realize it now. But that's super, super important. And to be honest, you talk about the highlights that we have. So I'm gonna give a shout out to the strength coach's best friend, the recruiting coordinator. So Adam Cohen here is my best friend, my best. And then Brandon McDonald and Pat O'Connell at Towson University hooked me up too. So, it's easy to drive fast when you got to walk step into Ferrari. You know what I mean?
So I hear you. Yep.
I'm not one to take credit for these guys' God-given ability and for these coaches going out and doing an outstanding job of finding guys that have potential. And my job essentially is to enhance their genetic potential and maximize their genetic potential.
Right.
And what they're not good at, it's supposed to help on that. So it's like a double-edged sword. So on one side, you're good on this, not good on this. Let me see if I can sharpen that side and make you be a little bit more full. Let me make you a little bit better. And that's how I kind of approach it. I just some of the stuff, we had a dunk, like Bryce had a dunk a couple of days ago at Washington.
I saw that. That was unreal.
Yeah, I'm like, that was Bryce being Bryce.
Right. Like, and that's another sign of a good strength coach is, he's a good athlete. He's going to do that no matter what. I'm going to hopefully keep him happy and healthy so he can do that. But
the one thing about Bryce that I do is, so the older you get in my program, the more autonomy you have. So right. Bryce has been with me for a little time now. So he'll be like, I feel like this, stuff like that. Okay. Like, there's certain things you're going to do. Like, we have our staple that you are going to do. But I feel like, okay, cool. I'm fine with it.
Right.
Now, the summertime, off-season time, it's more my way. But like right now, he's not giving a lot of time to me.
Right. And he's shown through days and weeks and months and years that he can get better in the weight room. He can stay healthy on the court. He can perform well. And that allows him to have those rewards and those benefits. Whereas a freshman coming in, like, you haven't proven that yet. You got to give it some time in order for me to give you that flexibility. Let's work together here. But I think too many people want the rewards and the benefits and all the extra, and they haven't earned it yet or shown that they can earn.
Freshmen have zero wiggle room at all. They do it my way,
right?
How I want it done. Unless the doc or AT says something's going on, it's going to be done this way because I'm laying the foundation.
Right. How long have you been at Stanford?
I'm going into year two. This is my second season. So maybe okay. 18 months. So it's been, I'm starting to get to accrue some time here to where things are kind of settling into my way and how I've things set up.
Right. One of these quotes I saw, I forget if it was on your Twitter or if it was in a video, and you talked about the importance of mirroring principles that the sport coach has. So if they practice with intent on the court, you want to practice with intent in the weight room. How has that been at Stanford or at other schools that you've been at?
It's been pretty good. I feel like every coach wants to play fast.
Yeah,
every basketball coach says, I want to play fast, right? Yep. So, like, we train fast. Attention to detail. I don't repeat myself more than once. I refuse. Ask a teammate, don't ask me. Whatever your core value, like at Stanford, our core values are invested, tough, selfless. I demand that of them. Like how they talk to each other matters to me. I was like, when I first got here, we had a freshman and a junior at Iraq who was in season later on in the year, and the freshman was messing up and the junior kind of snapped at him, like, it's kind of dickish. I stopped the lift and corrected it right there, because how you communicate dictates so much.
Right.
So that was a teaching, a learning opportunity, a teaching opportunity for me to give there. So I am very much so in tune to what they say. It's kind of cool because like my head coach is like he's a pretty good man, like good person. A lot of times our messages kind of match up a lot. So it's kind of cool to be able to work with someone you kind of have the same ideas as philosophically, you know. Team first always, you know, all the generic BS everybody says, like, but you know, at the end of the day, it's like, we're gonna work hard every day. We're gonna commit to the process. We're gonna commit to doing things the right way daily. We're not gonna, you know, and I think that's the biggest thing.
One of the quotes that I saw as well was embrace, serve, and impact. And how do you fulfill each of those, not only in your daily life, but in your overall career and just the way you embody yourself, not only as a strength coach, but as a person and a member of your community?
That's a really good question.
I try. When I'm talking to anyone related to Stanford, I really try hard to have my P's and Q's together.
Well, you don't need that with me. I just work here. I'm not a Stanford guy like that. But, you know, that's something I came up with, I think, going into Towson. I was going to go into a job. I was my first time director. And I was going to run a department and have a staff. And I was like, man, how do I put the skill? Like, what's it going to take? And I thought about over my career, what has been the thing that in my mind that separates me? And in my mind, to be honest, what separates me is not my sports science brain or my this or my that. It's my ability to touch and move people. And the first thing is embrace. And the second thing is serve. And the last one's impact. But if you think about this, it's hard to serve someone if you can't get close to them. They keep you at a distance.
Right.
You have to be close enough to them where you can embrace and get close to them. And once I can get close to you, I can serve you and help you and do my job. And then once I'm doing that, now I can impact your life. And so that is how I go about my program, everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I tell them, I was like, you know, you may have Stanford for 4 years, but you got Mike for life.
I like that.
And you know, nothing you do, you know, is going to make me, you know, be done with you. I've seen it. I feel like I've seen most of it at this point in time.
Right.
But it's just really important for them to understand that, like, Mike sees me as the man. Mike doesn't see me as a basketball player. So, you know, I mentor the man and develop the player. And that is, in my opinion, what makes my relationships with my guys so strong. And, you know, I think if anyone sees us train, I want them to say two things. They're technically sounding, damn, they work hard.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And they don't work hard because I'm yelling and screaming and rah-rah on and beating. They work hard because they respect me and I respect them. And they know I'll give them the shirt off my back. And if they need me and they call me, I'm in the car, I'm on the way.
Right.
And that is what that means to me. In my community, I do what I can. But it's funny, it's like my community has become the guys because that's what I spend all my time with. But in times that
that's all you can with COVID, you know, you can't see too many other people. So
yeah,
it's funny exactly. That works that way.
Yeah, but you know, it's really important and imperative that you find ways to give back. And so community-wise, I will try to do anything that's asked of me that I can handle. My mom is a minister, so she does a lot of things with the church or whatever. So if ever she asks me like to talk to some groups or do something like that, I'm more willing to be involved. Or sometimes it's just being there, like being willing to work. Like everybody wants to like have this like really extravagant way of helping.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's going and serving plates or like moving boxes or mm-hmm. doing like the stuff that no one really sees but needs to be done, you know? And so I think that's my way of doing it. I kind of like to be in the background. If I ever get pushed to the forefront, it's because my work did it, not me. And I think that's how it should be.
Right. Everyone wants to serve until it's, you know, you need to go shovel snow. Oh, Minnesota here, we shovel snow in the winter. I know you guys don't, but maybe it's like, you got to go, you know, cut this lawn, or you got to move these boxes, you got to move furniture, you know, stuff that no one wants to do. But serving is really putting yourself, you know, secondary to what the mission or the goal or what the help is, and not just, oh, I'm going to serve, but I'm only going to do it in this way because I think this looks best and this reflects best on me and this looks best, you know, in a picture or in a news line or whatever. But it's doing whatever is needed whenever it's asked from people who really need it, whether that is, you know, someone like your mom or your team, or it's someone down the street, you know, help when you can. And that separates, again, an awesome coach from the average or standard coach as well.
And service and being a servant is so underrated, but so powerful. There's no way to get closer to someone than being able to serve them adequately and give them what they need. It's, you know, if you feed a hungry dog, it keeps coming back. You feed someone who needs something and you touch them and you do it, they keep coming back and you keep investing. And John Sanderson would always say to me about investment and returns. What you invest, you get a return on anything you do. Mm-hmm. And so I really invest in relationship. I invest in that. And I try to do it also with a servant's heart, which is in my mind just as important. Like, hey, don't look at me. Like, you know, it's okay to serve when no one's looking. It's okay for you to sweep the floor. It's okay for you to talk to the manager. It's okay for you to load the bus. It's okay for you to do those things. So, you know, you don't have to be this to be important.
Right. I absolutely agree with that. And I also think it's important that those expectations, that you're not expecting a reward back, you're not expecting a congratulations, you're not expecting a favor in return. You're doing out of the goodness of your heart and to help whatever situation or person that's there. And I think people have a real difficult time. And I have, you know, personally, where I do something and it's like, I didn't get anything back from that. Why did, you know, and we're so used to this transaction of time or service or job for money or appreciation or reward. And sometimes it's delayed. Sometimes it's, you know, you just pay it forward. And I think that's a big turning point for people, coaches and people in general, is when you can do that stuff without expecting anything back.
And so this is the thing for coaching that I've realized.
Right.
You can spend 3 years, 2 years with a player, just like investing. And he graduates and you're like, man, he didn't change at all. He calls you 2 years later. He's like, thank you. Sometimes it's planting the seed that's going to grow later on that we're missing out. But we can't plant the seed and demand the tree to be here tomorrow because we want it tomorrow. We got to let the seed maturate and grow and get to that point where we can see what's coming, so we can see the fruit of our labors. And that is really, truly what coaching is, especially, you know, off the court. Now, we also have a job where you have to win, but this is a huge part of it as well.
I really like that point, Mike, because I think that's really important for, in your situation, an athlete that struggled or they're always hurt or they didn't get the playing time and their experience wasn't what they expected and it seemed like it was negative and a struggle, but they didn't realize everything they gained from that until 2 years down the road, 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road. And then they're like, oh yeah, Mike was always there for me. Mike helped me out with this, you know, coach helped me out with that. And they appreciate it so much later. So that's good that you're being consistent and you're just continue to provide value despite what feedback you get, because you never know when it's going to hit a person. Oh, wow, Mike was there for me when I needed it. He really pushed me. He made me a better person.
Yeah, for sure.
Another thing in strength and conditioning is it's funny, like the job title, it always changes, whether it's a strength coach, strength conditioning coach, sports performance coach, whatever. But now it's taken so much more where we talk about, you know, speed work and balance and nutrition, mental health and recovery. How do you manage to work on all of that with your athletes and not get overwhelmed?
I had this conversation last night with somebody, actually. I chop down one tree at a time.
Sure.
You know, so, you know, like, if I see mental health is the need, mental health is the focus, and I'll put everything else on the background. Because mental health is the foundation for whatever you do in strength conditioning or performance. Because if the mind isn't healthy, the body's gonna follow. There's a time where, you know, like you have this big pie and you got strength and nutrition and all this. Right. You got to know at what point in time to close off that piece of the puzzle to make other pieces bigger, all that type of stuff, so you can kind of move around to hit everything. And then the other thing is that with you have a group of 15, 16 guys, everybody's going to do something different at different times. So you got to be able to organize your day and organize your time to be able to meet that need as effectively as possible, which means you need to be very well studied, very well versed in everything, so that when the time comes for you to speak on whatever that particular modality may be, that you're prepared for it. And so my way is always prepare, never take on more than one task at a time. Meet with my guys pretty regularly. You know, where are we right now in this process? We do personal development plans. Okay, we need to accomplish this year. All right, where are we with this? Okay, how do we get there? And so there's an outline and a way to do it where, you know, sometimes you try these meetings and it's always funny when you try to have a meeting. You go, so we're going to have a nutrition meeting right before lift. And the guys are like, yo, let's go. Like, I just want to lift. But when you say today we're going to spend 20 minutes to speak on nutrition and ask Q&A, it's a lot more quality. So understanding your audience, understanding how to present it, when to present it, and how to do all that is a huge piece of that puzzle.
I like that tree analogy because I think too often people go for like the smallest, weakest tree, which like it's the easiest thing to them, but it might not be the most important or the most urgent. So when we are talking mental health or talking nutrition or just talking about getting in the weight room more, sometimes those are really big trees and they're really scary, or they might be on fire. They're so urgent and we just put them on the side because it's too hard, it's too much. And deep down, we know that's what we need to work on, but we're afraid to go there, whether it's, you know, coach isn't pushing us or we don't recognize it in an athlete. And I do think it's important that to recognize which tree is the big tree and which one's the urgent tree and make sure we're attacking those before it gets out of control. So I really like that analogy you got there.
Yeah. And it's just one of those things to where like, just like training, there's no one way to do it. You know, like you see a lot of videos of like, you have strength coaches like getting the guys really hyped before the game, like getting them going. What if they need to be calmer?
Right.
What if they're already hyped, need to bring them down a little bit? Like there are times, so like, I'm just very mindful of my audience, who they are, where we are at the time, what's our state and how are we going to go about it?
That's what I needed growing up, because when I played sports, I had so much pregame anxiety and just anxiety about playing, and it got so bad and my heart rate is just racing. So what do? I listen to like loud rap music. I just like, you know, get into like the hype circle, and it's just like, Maybe that wasn't the best thing. You know, it's fun to do that stuff, but the first quarter comes like halfway in and you just crash and you're not there, you know, mentally, emotionally, physically, because you spent so much time, energy, and effort before the game and right away just to get, you know, hyped up. But it is, and it's not to get them, you know, too low where they're not, where they're lethargic and not ready to go, but find that happy medium.
Yep.
And I think it goes back to what we just talked about at the beginning, being consistent. It's really hard to come down when you're high, and it's really hard to get up when you're low. That's the role of a great strength coach and coach mentor in general, is to keep those athletes in that nice, consistent space. So it seems like you're doing a great job of that at Stanford. Thank you for taking time to jump on the podcast. I look forward to seeing how you guys do the rest of the season. And I hope our paths cross again soon, Mike.
All right. Thanks, Tom. I really appreciate you.